What is up, y'all? It's Bud Elliott here on the Knollcast, and I just wanted to drop a little solo episode. Been doing a lot of recruiting-related travel lately. Been doing some more travel as well for the show, and wanted to get a little solo pod out tonight, and then probably later in the week, jump back and do one with Graham. So maybe a little double dose of Knollcast. That'd be kind of cool. And a couple of important headlines I want to hit tonight. First, I want to talk about Tarpon Cellars. Tarpon Cellars Winery, great job out there in Cali. Delicious wine. Make sure you sign up for their program. They have it going on. It's awesome. My wife likes it. Graham's wife likes it. I like it. He likes it. Yeah, I'm not drinking any Tarpon Cellars currently, like not right at this minute, as you can see if you watch us on YouTube. And if you don't, if you're still one of those native audio folks, and we love y'all, give us that subscribe on YouTube. Even if you don't watch the show, it still just helps the channel look a little more legitimate when other folks check it out. Like, oh, 10,000 people like this channel. That's cool. We probably should have done a better job to push the YouTube subscriptions. But anyway, yeah, so just check that out if you want to. On the last episode, we talked about the 14-team college football playoff and what that might mean for the Noles. We always kind of take the news and we tell you how it relates to FSU on this show. I feel like it's something that we do pretty well. And I was not entirely opposed to the 14-team playoff proposal that came out, if you recall last show. And I think Graham, for the most part, was unopposed as well. Now, that at the time was without the new stipulation, ask whatever, that the SEC and Big Ten are making, that the SEC and Big Ten champions automatically get a bye. That, to me, is an entirely different ask than just going to 14. Going to 14 and earning your way in, yeah, I get it, right? Most of your teams that are going to win a national title are going to come from the SEC or the Big Ten. In fact, I think there are very few that I would think have a legitimate shot to win a national title in my lifetime that are not in there. In fact, I think there's only four. Florida State, Clemson, Miami, Notre Dame. Everybody else, I don't think so, to be honest. I'd be kind of beyond shocked. So, I get that. But asking for buys for the winners of the Big Ten and the SEC, I think it does so much to put the finger on the scale that it's basically an untenable ask. It's a poison pill, if you will, and something I think you just can't really go through with if you are the ACC or the Big 12. And yet they might have to because of the leverage that they lack in these negotiations. Although, as I'll get into, I think there are some situations where potentially you could call it and see what the Big 10 and SEC will actually do. So, let's say you're Jim Phillips, and you say, yeah, we're not going to vote for this. And the SEC and the Big Ten say, okay, we're going to break off and form our own Super League. And these two are clearly working in concert with each other, by the way. So, the SEC is, in almost all years, a superior league to the Big Ten. When it comes to playoff teams, the SEC has had 8 teams win a national title since the BCS began. And the Big Ten has had 3, Ohio State, Michigan, and now USC. For purposes of this argument, I am using the current conference affiliation. So Miami would count for the ACC, et cetera, right? Nebraska for the Big Ten doesn't count because they didn't win it in 99 or 2000. They won it prior to the BCS becoming a thing, although certainly still a program that at the time was pretty damn elite. So I look at this like, man, the ACC has like 3, the Big Ten has 3, and the SEC has 8 in terms of, like, let's just say teams over the last, 25, 26 years, whatever that is, a little more than that, actually. Why would the SEC agree with the Big Ten on the number of automatic qualifiers, the so-called 3-3-2-2-1 model, right? 3 for the SEC, 3 for the Big Ten, 2 for each of the ACC and Big 12, 1 for the Group of 5. Why would they agree that both these both these leagues get buys. I think they're just working together, right? To show some solidarity, to be able to threaten the rest of the room, the playoff, you know, room that is comprised of the conference commissioners and now, in some cases, the presidents of the schools. Because if you think that they're not working together, you are more likely to call their bluff and say, you know what? You're not really going to split off and make a super league this soon. I know Greg Sankey has talked about how he read the famous book about the Champions League over in Europe and all that stuff. But breaking off sounds great, but it is an absolute logistical nightmare in terms of administering all of these other sports. And if you just break off football, I don't think that's going to work real well when it comes to finding places for your basketball team and your baseball team and all of that stuff, because some of those sports, they do make some money. The basketball tournament makes a ton of money, obviously. You want to bet that they're probably not included in that if they break off football, the SEC and Big Ten. Now, that is what they have to project, though. They have to make these other leagues believe that they will actually break off. And I do think it's probably been explored, and I'm not going to tell you that it is a non-zero chance. But if you did not believe they were truly working together, which they announced they were with a quote-unquote working group, right, and the fact that they are agreeing to an equal number of automatic qualifiers, even though the SEC, with the current composition of teams, is vastly superior to that of the Big Ten, that probably drives home the message, hey, we are in this together. We are driving this boat. So if you're Jim Phillips, if you vote for this, there's a real chance that you lose your teams, some of the teams at least, to the Super League, the Big Ten, most likely as the landing spot, I would think, for FSU. I bet my house on it that the Big Ten is more likely than the SEC at this point. But I don't know where some of the other teams in the conference in the ACC might end up. That's sort of TBD if they did do it. If you do vote for it, though, you're also admitting a part of Florida State's lawsuit that you're not being a good steward for the future of the top teams in your league. You are admitting that your conference is less than those conferences, which it is, in fairness. That is an accurate statement based on the results. There are a lot of teams in the ACC that are inferior to what you put on the field in the SEC. And I would say also, for the most part, to the Big Ten. So it's a little tricky for Jim Phillips. This is the buys thing really kind of tips this and screws it up. The 3-3-2-2-1, we already talked about how it makes it a little bit trickier vote, but the buys thing, because it's a competitive imbalance thing. Now, the reason why they want it is twofold. One, the SEC's championship game is a pretty big deal to them, and because they started the whole idea of a championship game, it was what, Roy Kramer back in the day in Birmingham, 92, with Bama, Florida. That's a big deal for them. It also is a pretty big moneymaker. And ESPN, when they bought the rights, I'm sure, you know, cared about that an awful lot. The Big Ten, though, has never really had it be a huge moneymaker, although it does make money, because of the great imbalance in the divisions that they've had. So, that is my thought there, is they care about keeping those conference title games. Who gives a flip about the ACC title game? Like, I've been to a couple of them. As a journalist, I've been to a couple just as a fan. They suck, honestly, for the most part. Like, Charlotte's not a cool city to go to in December. It's usually cold and rainy. It's outside. The game's usually played at night, which makes it colder. People are slipping on the field. It's not a good environment. To me, the experience kind of sucks overall. So, and you're usually playing a fan base that also doesn't show up and doesn't care. Part of that is the divisional stuff. Part of that is because of the fact that Miami has just never, ever held up its end of the bargain as far as the rematch from your cross-division opponent, which is how the league has been, you know, constructed for most of the history. So, yeah, if the ACC says no, do the Big Ten and the SEC actually have an out to be like, all right, you guys forced our hand, we have to break off now? Possibly. Like, I think the Big Ten and the SEC do care about image a little bit as they're ruining our sport, right? And I'm saying that not just as a Noles fan, but like as a college football fan. The way they're going about this, I don't think is very good. for the health of the overall sport. But we root for businesses. We need to admit that we do, and we need to stop thinking about decisions that are made about this sport from the lens of competitiveness, collegiality, tradition. No, we root for a business, okay? It's a weird thing. I also think that politically, the Big Ten and the SEC breaking off to form some sort of super league, if they can actually paint this as our hand was forced, we had to do it, that type of thing, man, there's going to be some hell to pay. Like, how do you think that would play in the Florida legislature? How do you think that would play in the Kentucky legislature? How do you think that would play in Georgia, where Georgia goes off? Well, actually, that's probably fine because Georgia like rewrote the Freedom of Information Act laws for Kirby. So, you know, maybe that will be totally fine in UGA. But there are a number of states where it's like, wait, what? We got one team and it's leaving, one team that's not. Would you like to come before this House Investigative Committee? Okay, yeah, let's do that. So maybe not the best idea there, but we'll see how it plays out. From an FSU perspective, I generally lean to the idea that the cavalier actions of the Big Ten and the SEC here with this proposal, which, by the way, could just be a bargaining chip to get more guaranteed money out of everything. But I generally believe that this probably helps to speed up FSU's exit process from the ACC. That's my general thought, but I don't know if I'm married to that thought. Strong convictions held weekly, potentially, is something to ponder there. But yeah, that's the 14 team. I think it made total sense for what they were trying to do. The 14 team with the buys, now that's a little different. That really is a different beast than what they were rolling on. All right, so somebody asked me, what do we think here as far as, like, is UF schedule really that much harder than Florida State's schedule? And I mean, clearly it's harder. It's arguably the hardest schedule in the history of college football. However, we do need to figure out one thing here. If you're calculating this, is Florida State playing itself, or does Florida, like if Florida State had UF schedule, would it still get to play the Gators as its final game, or would it have to play an FSU equivalent team? That actually shifts this a little bit. So you look at this. I mean, if FSU had this schedule, okay, Miami at home, you're favored by less than a touchdown. Samford, you're favored by a million, whatever. Texas A&M at home, I think you're favored by less than a touchdown. At Mississippi State, you're probably favored by, less than 10 for sure. You're not laying double digits on the road at Mississippi State. UCF at home, I would say less than 10, but probably over a touchdown, most likely. At Tennessee for the Noles, I would say that's largely a coin flip. Hosting Kentucky, that's probably a spread of less than 10. You're not double digits at home, I don't think, over Kentucky. Georgia on a neutral site, you're probably, 12 to 13 points less than Georgia on a power rating scale. So let's call it like definitely more than 10, but slightly less than 2 touchdowns, I guess, maybe. But there's certainly going to be bias if you played that game from the Orange Bowl that you just played. At Texas, you're probably an underdog of slightly more than a touchdown, I would think. Hosting LSU, who you did beat the last 2 years, we should note, you'd be favored by, I would say, less than a touchdown. Ole Miss, again, at home, I think you'd be favored by less than a touchdown. Yeah, I mean, guys, Florida's schedule is probably 2 wins or 2 losses tougher than FSU's. FSU's current win total on FanDuel is 9.5. It is juiced to the under. So kind of 9-3 is the expectation for the Noles this year by Vegas. I think it would be like 7.5 juice under with that schedule. I mean, what games, if you actually played that, are locks? Samford? There's not another game that I would bet my house on that you'd win, most likely. I mean, at Mississippi State, but it's still on the road. Starkville's not a real, not a crazy easy place to play if you're not an amazing team. Like, Bama would not generally struggle there when they were, like, peak Alabama. You know, peak Georgia, peak Ohio State-level teams are probably not going to struggle there. But if you're just, like, a really good team and not, like, an amazing team, like, not a, you know, not a serious national title contender, which I don't think Florida State is, obviously, with what they lost. I mean, I think they'll be a playoff contender. I don't think they're a natty contender. That could be a difficult game. So, I'm not trying to say that FSU schedule is easy, because it's certainly not easy. It's also not fair to say that FSU would struggle against a typical SEC schedule, because the Gator schedule is far from typical. Also, clearly, like, if you had to play in Tallahassee as the Noles, if you were somehow an FSU equivalent level team, but you were the road team in Tallahassee, then you would be a slight dog there. So, going 8-4 against that schedule would be, at least at present, pretty nice. Do want to tell you about my friend at Legendary Home Loans. Chad does a great job. 844-FSU-LOAN, 844-FSU-LOAN is the number to call. You can also check out the website. Just click the link in our show notes. We make it really easy for you. Simple. I've used them twice to get my home loans. I may use them a third time coming up. More than 525 Nolcast listeners have as well. As Graham says, it's been one of the most successful advertising partnerships in American podcasting history, especially relative to the size of the show. Like, who sells 500 home loans in 3.5 years? That's kind of nuts. But they did with a little bit of help from us. So yeah, awesome to promote those guys. And the feedback we get consistently is excellent. So I strongly encourage you all to use them. They are loyal supporters of the show. Couple thoughts on the combine here before we do some recruiting chatter. First of all, I didn't hear a damn person say, oh, Florida State should have played in the Orange Bowl, should have had their guys play the Orange Bowl, when they saw them running those excellent times up and down the board, for the most part, in the combine. You had a lot of guys that decided to skip the Orange Bowl because they were actually hurt. Now, were they too hurt to play? In almost all cases, no. Did people at Florida State encourage them to get whatever surgeries they needed to get or any kind of cleanups or start their rehab process immediately after the snub? Yes, they did. Okay. That's not throwing the game. That's, hey, man, we got screwed by the system. Why are we going to give it back to the system and give them more of us when we can go get ours? All right. What we worked for was 13-0. In fact, if you go to like Mike Gravel's coaching clinic or any kind of the, like what FSU sends out media-wise, it's 13-0. Like, they're very, they're pretty on this narrative and selling 13-0 undefeated, which I can get on board with, honestly. So nobody really complained about that. It was weird. It's like, oh yeah, these guys are really good. I thought Ira Shaffel had a great tweet. He's like, man, if you're a Georgia fan, you're like, who the hell are these guys at the combine? Like, not the guys that Georgia ran all over in the Orange Bowl. Thought number two. You know my thoughts on this staff. I think it's a good staff overall. I think it's a very good coaching staff. I think they do a pretty good job of connecting with their players. I think it is a good developmental staff. I think it's just a really, really good coaching staff. I do not think it is a good staff when it comes to sales, and that's a different skill. It just is. On the recruiting trail, you can debate me how much that matters in today's day and age. I think I'll win the debate, but I'm open, you know, to debate. This does give you another thing to sell, right? If you don't have great salespeople, if you don't have high effort, high energy, high relationship building salespeople, it does help to have a really good product. And to see all these FSU guys getting a bunch of love for how they did at the combine, I think that's big time. I do think that can help you recruit some, and we'll be seeing, you know, how that impacts their recruiting both in the transfer spring window, because a lot of your development was done via the transfer kids, but also how it plays in high school, right? I'm sure FSU's sending out clips to kids already. Hey, look at this, look at this, look at this. This kid killed the combine. He was developed here. He was developed here. He was developed here. All that kind of stuff matters in sales. It really does. Now, as far as winners and losers of the combine, I thought Trey Benson was a clear winner, right? To have a speed score. If you guys don't know what speed score is, it's not this RAS score, which I think is fine and is pretty good. But speed score specifically is kind of like your speed relative to how big you are. And for running backs, it does have some predictive value. I think Benson had the second or third best speed score in the entire combine. That's good, because on tape, scouts are going to say, okay, does Trey Benson have good vision? Not particularly, not by NFL standards. Does he have great agility? No, not really. But at his size, once he gets going, can he hit home runs by virtue of being really hard to bring down at top speed? Yes. And we do see some backs in the NFL succeed with that skill set, that explosive home run hitting skill set. There is a place for that in the league. His deficiencies as a player were seen on tape. His skills as a player were seen on tape. For him to put up a 4.39 at that size is a big deal for Trey Benson. I think will really help his draft stock. I don't know what round he's going to go in. I saw some mock drafts today with round 3. I mean, God, I think if Trey Benson goes top 100, I think that's a really nice thing for him. Maybe he could go second round. I don't think there's any reason to take a running back this year in the first round. I don't see anybody, you know, who has first round type talent. Keon Coleman. I mean, look, let's just be honest. The 40 sucked. It did. That's a 40 that's going to cost Keon Coleman some money unless he comes around on his pro day and runs a lot faster. And you could tell me that he was faster in drills than a lot of the other guys, and that is true. If you like comp his gauntlet to, I think it was Troy Franklin that they were showing on NFL Network, he was running that drill much faster and still catching the ball than Franklin was. And that matters. And I think increasingly, because they have some of the mile an hour data, teams do care about what you run in the 40, but they also care about, you know, how you perform in the drills and what speed you perform in these drills. Are you kind of going half speed? So you look pretty, but also like you're not really going full speed through it. Blake Corum at running back is a good example of this. His 40 was not impressive. It was not poor, but it was just not special. But his drills, his lateral cutting ability, his ability to make those cuts at full speed, the stop start was really special. And you see how Corum was just such an effective runner, you know, for Michigan. That can be a hard thing to scout, by the way. But you know, Coleman hurt himself with the 40 time. I was a little surprised that it was 4.64. I did not think he was going to run in the 4.4s, but I thought, you know, 4.5 something. 4.64, that's going to cost you money. I can't sugarcoat that, and I won't. However, I don't think the speed has ever really been a major part of his game that teams are now having to go back to the tape and question. He didn't run by anybody for the most part this year. He ran by some LSU guys, certainly, when he was healthier. But he's an elite contested catch guy, red zone guy, third down type guy. And there's a lot of value. Some people compare him to a T. Higgins. I think that makes a lot of sense, to be honest. And T. Higgins is a hell of a ball player for Cincinnati, or I guess wherever he ends up in free agency if he hits it. I think Johnny Wilson, I mean, the largest wingspan ever for a receiver at the combine. 6'6.5", 230, running in the 4.5s. I think Johnny Wilson made some money. Like, quick. Clear, like, you'd rather have Brock Bowers. But the rest of this tight end class is pretty mid, man. Coming off a tight end class last year that was elite, like a lot of big-time tight ends. And Johnny Wilson's not a tight end. He wants to get paid as a receiver. I think he'll be played as a receiver. But if you look on body types, would you rather have Johnny Wilson, or would you rather have the second best tight end or a third? Like, I'm taking Johnny Wilson, I think, before I take a second tight end in this draft. So for that reason, because there were so many damn good receiver numbers put up this year at the combine, I don't think Johnny's a loser in this. I think he's actually a winner because of team's ability to justify the pick to themselves. Say, hey, man, for a big body guy, we'd rather have them than this tight end. Speaking of tight ends, Jaheim Bell, I think he, like, his time was good. His time was not special for his size, and because he's going to be comped more to like receivers and like pass catching fullback type guys. There's just a lot of receivers that I think I would rather have than Jaheim Bell. So, you know, I didn't really expect him to do better than he did, but if he wanted to move up in the draft a lot, he was going to have to do better than he did, in my opinion. Jared Verse, I thought, did a very nice job. He tested and performed roughly as expected. I also think he's a good example of somebody who came back, made real NIL money from what everybody understands, and found a slot in the draft in which, like, last year's edge rusher class was pretty loaded. This year's edge rusher class, less so. So, kid from Alabama, kid from UCLA, and then Chop Robinson from Penn State. Those are the only three defensive ends who I think you might consider taking over Jared Verse. And that is not me saying that you would take all three of them. I'm just saying, like, the at worst, he's your fourth best defensive end on the grading scale in this draft. At best, he could be your number one. I don't know, but I think he's cemented himself as a first-round grade, whereas last year, you could say he wasn't that much better of a player this year, although I thought he did the small stuff better this year. Last year, the competition was considerably higher in the draft, and so he came back, he made some cash, and he probably moved up half a round, maybe a full round, depending on where he goes. We'll have to see. That's a nice move for Jared Verse, and I think a good tale for Mike Norvell to be able to tell his guys, hey, you can come back. You can make a pretty nice little living, okay? And then you can go pro when you're ready to go pro. I don't know. Like, imagine you strike an NIL deal for $500K or whatever, you know, whatever Verse got. I don't actually know. Man, like, even after like cutting your agent 3%, or some of these guys pay more because it's a quote unquote marketing deal, so the agents get away with charging more, and taxes and some other stuff. Man, like, imagine just being able to start your life post college, even if the NFL didn't exist, as somebody who, you know, could have $200,000 down payment on a house. That's a pretty big deal, or even more, right? It depending on how you managed it. And hell, maybe you just bought Bitcoin and now you're, this is not financial advice, but maybe you're up to like 800,000 now, or, you know, close to a million, depending on when you bought it. Braden Fisk, I thought, had the exact type of combine he needed to have to move up into like the middle or upper part of the second round. I did not know his arms were going to be that short. Like, I knew they weren't long. You can eyeball the guy. I did not know they were going to measure that short. However, the testing that he had, the ferocity with which he attacked the drills and the testing numbers, I mean, that was just awesome. Like, that's what you want. That is how you combine that with a relatively weak defensive tackle class. You have Murphy, you have Tavondre Sweat, you have the kid from Illinois. There's one other who, at this moment, I'm trying to look at the screen, not just look at my computer. One other whose name escapes me, but it's not a great interior defensive line class this year. So why not take a chance on Braden Fisk in, I don't know, maybe the middle of round two? I think Kalen DeLoach now has a real chance to get drafted running in the 4.4s. When you're 5'11 and 206, 207, whatever he measured, that's just not going to get it done in the NFL unless you're really, really fast. And you know what? Kalen DeLoach ran really, really fast. They're going to go back to the tape and say, hey, does he play that fast? On some downs, he absolutely does. On some downs, you know, maybe not. But that's everybody. But if you are that small, and he's tiny by NFL standards, not by just regular human standards, you better be really damn fast and you better have some special instincts and you better really be able to cover. But I do think that Deloach can get drafted now because of the speed. And I wasn't always of that opinion. You know, he got better this year. I thought that was pretty impressive. Now, Green at corner, I probably hurt him a little bit, but the All-Star games that he had combined with the excellent tape, I think teams, they generally know what he is. I kind of doubt he's going to be asked to play in a scheme where he's required to run with receivers all the way down the field. It's just not his skill set. He does not have good long speed by NFL standards. But you know, the time for him was a little bit disappointing, but I guess relative to like maybe what you hoped it could have been, not like what you thought it would have been. But still, overall, I think good in drills and largely okay. And then Jerrion Jones, man, nice running. I think that largely solidified him as a draft pick and moved him up maybe around maybe two with that length and that time and the rapid progression, the late onset progression that he had. Teams might think, it took this guy a while to figure it out. He was actually a pretty poor player in 2021 and then a mixed bag in 22 and pretty lights out in 23, to be honest. So maybe there's more. Maybe that rapid ascension of him as a player is something that we would like to have in our organization. And maybe he's going to continue to improve at that rapid rate. So yeah, guys, that's a hell of a thing to sell. That's a really nice haul. Josh Storms, you know who's got ammo to kind of put his foot in somebody's ass in offseason conditioning? Storms. Because he's got trophies on the wall now, right? Those 40 times, those combine performances, those percentile ranks, 90th, 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 all that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that's all Josh Storms, but if I was Josh Storms, I would definitely say that's all me, right? This is how we get guys to stay motivated. This is how we get guys in the dog days of summer to keep giving 100%. And if you're Norvell, that's a thing maybe can help you on the recruiting trail. Our strength program is elite. Guys get better. That's sort of something that they probably will need to continue saying. And now Storms has a little more ammo in his quiver to promote that, which I thought was cool. Also, like, it's not crazy to think that you could have, I mean, DJ could get invited to the combine depending on how he plays. Roydell Williams could. Malik at receiver could. If Kentron plays really well, he potentially could. Morlock, I guess, like, I can't rule out a breakout there. You could have one or two linemen. I think Byers is the one that's almost certainly the quote-unquote lock. And then Washington, you know, as an older guy, I don't know if they really would, but maybe. And then defensively, I could see four or five guys on the defensive side. Peyton, Shaim, Fentrell, AZ, Daryl Jackson, Josh Farmer. So, like, I don't think I have listed off a bunch of top picks, but I think I've listed off a bunch of picks there. Like, a decent number of guys, maybe not the offensive side, but like a decent number of those guys on defense are, in my opinion, surefire draft picks. So, yeah. That's a good selling point, too. If you got a bunch of guys who are on draft lists already, that's a good thing. I will note, by the way, that we had said on this podcast that we thought Cam Kitchens at Miami was kind of not that fast and was guessing a lot, and that's why he was out of position because he knows he's not that fast. And he does make a lot of plays, although I think sometimes he does guess, and he has good instincts, too, to go with it. He ran like 4.63 as a safety. That's a problem for sure, because I don't think he really plays faster than that. Just a note. Second note, Ricky Pearsall, Gators receiver who killed FSU in 2022. We got on this show and complained about it because literally they had no other healthy receivers other than true freshmen that year. And it was Anthony Richardson and Pearsall and like nothing else. At least at least if you're Adam Thor, you can say, all right, you know what? That guy who killed us, who we should have found ways to stick with better because he was their only weapon and it was very obvious pregame. At least he ran really, really well and jumped out of the gym. One of the better relative athletic scores, RAS, of the day. All right, final note here is a little bit longer, I think, a little recruiting note. So do want to tell you guys about Charlie Park, restaurant Charlie Park. Awesome. Make sure you get your reservations in for the spring game. I talked to Matt Thompson. These are moving kind of fast. We do want to get your reservations in for Charlie Park. It's an awesome spot. Great weather for the spring game, most likely. So get to Charlie Park, get your reservation in day of spring game, day before, maybe day after, whatever you want to do. If you're in town, it is a really dope spot to hit up. Also, Congruity HR Solutions. Have Matt Lewis optimize your business. He's done ours. I think he's done about 10 other Knollcast adjacent businesses. Hit him in the show notes. Congruity HR Solutions. That's who you need to hit up. Proud supporters of the show. I think they do a tremendous job for us. And we are really, really excited to continue working with those guys. So, been to some high schools recently. Been to some different college campuses. Been to multiple recruiting camps. Couple Under Armour camps, IMG Pro Day, all that kind of stuff. And I have, certainly not a trend, and I don't want to be negative here. I'm going to be comparative, and I'm going to note the differentials in timeline. But I will say this. As a guy who has covered recruiting in the state of Florida for about 15 years, I'm pretty underwhelmed with the talent this year. I'm not real impressed with the 2025 recruiting class in the state of Florida. To me, I've seen like one guy who I think is a no doubt five star, and that's DJ Pickett, the safety out of Tampa. I mean, I think he's just, well, sorry, corner, but he's like a freak of freaks. FSU's not really involved there, but I guess stranger things have happened. Other than that, so far, I want to say this correctly. It is almost a certainty that the state of Florida would produce more than one five-star prospect, especially if you count IMG, although I'll get to there. I'm not really sure that there's a five-star at IMG this year. Good number of four-stars. I don't know about a five-star. It's a virtual lock that you will have more than one five-star from the state of Florida. And I'm not making these rankings, but man, I'm telling you, like, I'm just not seeing a whole lot of guys who I'm like, oh yeah, that's a stud. That's a stud. Like he's a no doubter. He's a no doubter. Just real big time difference makers. It seems like it's down. And I don't know if I've ever really talked about this on a show before, but like where would Armando Blunt rank in this class who signed with Miami? Like where would Jason Zandamello rank? Would he be your second best player in the state? Like would JoJo Trader, who was on 24/7 Sports, the 11th rated player last year in the state of Florida, would he be your best player in the state this year? I think it's kind of possible. Honestly, like that, I mean, that's what we're talking about here. If you mashed up like last year's class and this year's class so far, and more guys will emerge, more guys will have greater exposure to, we'll have new testing stuff. We'll see guys at certain camps. We'll learn more about them. We'll see how they perform when they face elite competition, some 7-on stuff, and they'll have their senior years as well. But it's not crazy to think that if you mashed up last year's class and this year's class, that 8 or 9 of the top 10 would come from that 2024 class that just signed, than the 25 class. And if you're a Noles fan, like that does suck a little bit because you missed on LJ McCray and you missed on some of those guys and Jeremiah Smith last year, and you missed on some of those dudes who were elite level, like special, pretty rare prospects that don't come around every single year. I don't want to dwell on that because I like the class FSU brought in. And I think that they will do a good job recruiting, you know, this year. If you combine that with the transfer portal, I think it should make them competitive for the playoff. Will it make them competitive for a national title? I don't know. We'll see. Possibly. It just kind of depends on – they would just need quarterback to really hit, I think. But I'm not real in love with what I'm seeing so far out of the class of 2025, specifically in the state of Florida. Now, I'm going to spin this in a positive direction. FSU has been trying to lay the groundwork in the state of Georgia with kind of varying levels of success. This year, though, if Auburn doesn't have a good year on the field, that you could have some potential blood in the water weakness, right? We don't know what Alabama will look like. We don't know necessarily. I think Tennessee will probably be pretty good this year. I'm trying to think about other schools who recruit the state of Georgia pretty hard. You know, Florida recruits it hard. They're probably not going to have an amazing record. Maybe the state of Georgia this year is more quote-unquote gettable than it has been in recent years, aside from UGA, which kind of has right of first refusal on not all, certainly, but a good number of kids. It's not quite like how Bama was in the state of Alabama for a long time. But yeah, it's a good thing that FSU is recruiting the state of Georgia hard, because I'm not seeing a ton of like really, really special prospects in the state of Florida. I have got my eyes on a good number though in recent weeks. And I wanted to kind of discuss a little bit of this with you. Pull my notes up here. Okay. I'll just kind of go positionally here. Tramell Jones, I think, is a nice get for FSU. I actually spoke with one of his coaches the other day, and he was telling me like how, yeah, Tramell does a lot of RPO type stuff in their system, but a very intelligent kid trying to communicate to all of his teammates a lot as far as like the different things they're doing. And you know, it's his coach. Of course, he's going to speak highly of him, but he did have a lot of confidence. Given the fact that you just signed Brock Glenn, and FSU likes Brock Glenn, like they think Brock Glenn is legit, and you just signed Luke, it is going to be hard to get a special level quarterback to sign back to back to back if you're not a team that's like sending a bunch of quarterbacks to the NFL, like a Lincoln Riley. You know, Mike Norvell is a hell of an offensive coach. He does not have like a Lincoln Riley type track record when it comes to QBs getting picked number one overall in the draft. And certainly that's not a guarantee you're going to recruit well, by the way. We've seen a guy, Jimbo Fisher, who failed to recruit quarterbacks well, even after having a ridiculous track record of elevating them and sending them to the National Football League. My point is, like, I think Tramell Jones is a nice fit for this. He's a guy who can develop on his own time, and maybe he turns into something for you. I think you have to like the odds of one of Glenn, Luke, or Tramell hitting. I do. I think that's pretty nice. Is he a special quarterback prospect? No, not at this point. We will see how he continues to develop and grow. I think he's a nice quarterback prospect. I think he's one that FSU is probably pretty happy to have in the boat. All right. As far as other commitments, what's his name? I did not get to see Javen Hilson at either of the camps. Again, a little bit shorter, twitchier edge rusher type that I think FSU needs to get into the program. And I think that's largely a good take. I gave you my Ethan Pritchard thoughts, I believe, last time, but if I didn't, I will repeat them. Undersized linebacker, but can really run. If that sounds like Kalen DeLoach, I think Pritchard is a good bit better than DeLoach was coming out of high school, and I've seen him quite a bit, playing in the Orlando area. Solomon Thomas, I think he's a guard, but I think he's a very nice guard prospect. Body control, balance, power, punch, intensity. It's a good sign if other elite programs are trying to take your players. That was one of the concerns I had with this 2024 class down the stretch. It's like, okay, we know who FSU is fighting for the uncommitted guys. Who are they playing defense again? And in some cases, they were playing defense against some good programs. In other cases, I'm like, man, what? Like, why are you having to fight a battle with Kentucky or Louisville or like NC State or like Mississippi State or Arkansas for a kid. Like, that's not a good sign to me if you believe in the wisdom of the markets, right? You want to be fighting off programs like Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State, you know, teams that actually compete for and win national titles. You got a lot of big-time schools still trying to get Solomon Thomas. To me, that is a good sign, right? Like, you should not ignore the wisdom of the markets when it comes to recruiting. That just is a smart thing. Well, it'd be a dumb thing to ignore them. I think you should follow the wisdom of the markets. All right, I saw Sean Simeon, South Florida running back, kid out of Naples. First live exposure to him. I thought he caught the ball extremely well. I thought he had a great feel for how to play the game. I went back and watched some of his highlights. I can see the same thing there. The only real question is, like, is he twitchy? Does he have game-changing speed? Because he's not that big. And if you're not that big, I need you to be pretty damn fast. So I don't know if he's like a real, I don't know, FSU-level guy. I'd like to see more. Now, Josh Moore, receiver. I will say FSU is in on some receivers who I actually like quite a bit. Now, they're a little bit outside looking in right now with Josh Moore, but I think that, you know, who knows? That could potentially change. He was wearing some Georgia wristbands at the Under Armour camp on Sunday. This dude is pretty freaky size-wise, and he's still learning how to play the position. He's younger than grade level, I believe. So, man, Josh Moore's a guy that definitely is worth following. He plays at North Broward. I think this guy has a little something to him. Vernell Brown is really, really nice. He actually kind of, Orlando kid near me, he's kind of got a little, like, a little Antonio Brown gameplay style, not the crazy off-field, you know, likely CTE type stuff. I know FSU staff likes him a ton. The speed is legit. It's sort of like, you driven a Tesla lately? You ever rent one or if you own one, whatever. How it's just like, it's that instant on speed. Man, Vernell Brown kind of has that. Like, that kind of just ability to separate away from defenders is pretty nice. So I do like Vernell Brown. He's not the biggest. Is he as good as like one of those top three or four receivers that we had in the state last year? In my opinion, he is not at this point. But I do think among the guys in the state, he's one of the best that I've seen so far this year. Dallas Wilson, obviously out of Tampa Bay Tech, have not seen him so far in the camp circuit this year, but I have a lot of live exposure to him. FSU's been in on him. We'll see how that recruitment goes. You've had a lot of busts in college football out of the Tampa area recently, but and St. Pete area, but you also get some good ones. I mean, Michael Penix ended up being a pretty good hit from, what, 6 years ago now? And Dallas Wilson, certainly a guy with the size, kind of like linear skill set, you know, size, speed, skill set, not amazing agility, but the ability to go downfield and go up and get the ball is there with him. Two defensive linemen to take a look at. Jalen Wiggins, who I believe is currently committed to Florida, Tallahassee kid. He's listed as an edge on a lot of these sites. I just don't see it with him at the edge. When I see Jalen Wiggins, I see somebody who, in the drills that require him to go straight ahead, I like. When they require him to stop, start, change direction, move laterally, I don't like as much. I don't know that he has great lateral agility and bend. I think he's somebody who needs to be an interior penetrator based on the skill set that I've seen so far. And I think he will continue to put on good weight, regardless of which program he ends up at. So if I'm FSU, I would still recruit Jalen Wiggins. But, like, to me, I think he's an interior guy, personally. Myron Charles is interesting to me. So last year, the tape is really good. Port Charlotte plays sort of a mixed quality schedule, which you should keep in mind if you go watch his highlights, because they are pretty nice. Last year, it looked like he had no idea what he was doing running through these drills and did not look twitchy. The body last year actually was a little bit sloppy. This year, it's like he's not a super imposing looking dude, but he's tightened up a little bit as he tend to do if you're an elite athlete and you go from 16 years old to 17 or 17 to 18, however old he is. I thought in the limited one-on-ones that he took, he was fairly decent. I'd be interested to see what his testing numbers are, if we can find those out. Because that, like, when I watch him, I don't see elite-level game-wrecker athlete. But when I watch his tape, I see a guy who's very productive and does make a lot of things happen. So, again, I don't see an LJ McCray in the state this year. I don't see a Timmy Jernigan in the state this year. I don't see a real, like, that level of player. So you got to kind of make do with what you got. And I would recruit Myron Charles. I would recruit Wiggins. I think they're both interior players, by the way. Charles, there's no doubt. Wiggins, some people seem to think, is an edge. I disagree with that. Ethan Pritchard, already talked about. TJ Alford, linebacker at Aviro. I kind of think he's more of like a Jack Fox type player. I don't know if he's a true linebacker. That's just my assessment. I'm not saying that I'm fully sold on that assessment, by the way. It's just sort of an off-the-cuff eval by me there. Some others believe that he can play linebacker, but I don't know. We'll see on that. But a guy that I think they will continue to recruit. Daryl Johnson is a safety that a lot of people think is a linebacker. But, like, I mean, why? I don't know. You play so much sub-package stuff. I think he's basically a bigger, like, downhill safety or a nickelbacker, depending on how you want to deploy him. I don't know if he's a true, like, open field safety, but FSU is recruiting him as a safety. So in my opinion, they probably envision him with a more hitter enforcer type role from the safety position. And then finally, Hilton Stubbs. I like Hilton Stubbs. I don't know if he's, like, I don't think he's a five-star type player, but I do think he's a productive guy who has some real ability to go get the ball with his length as well. I think he can tackle. I think he has a nice, well-rounded skill set and is a dude who could help FSU. So that's all to say, like, watch Georgia a lot this year. I'm going to keep my eye on the state of Florida to see if we got more kids who emerge. The one kid I really wanted to see is the guy at Tampa Robinson. But I haven't seen him because he didn't make it to either camp, unfortunately. Well, shoot. Now I can't remember the kid's name. His film's kind of nasty. So I was hoping to see him in person. He looks like he might be a freak. And I know some other folks who have seen him in person and they like it, but they haven't seen him in, like, a live eval, like a camp setting. Which you do want, because you get a sense for the guy's body, you get a sense for how the guy competes against other elite players, which does matter, and you get measurements off these camps and like measurements and then also like verified times as well. That's kind of your basic recruiting rundown. But yeah, watch Georgia, because right now I'm not seeing this is one of the lesser state of Florida recruiting classes I can remember. Man, I'm trying to think, like, you know, in 2023, we had Keon Keeley, we had Jordan Hall, we had Cormani, we had Raylan Wilson, we had Carnell Tate, that was IMG, we had Hakeem, we had CJ Baxter, we had Brandon Ennis, Desmond Ricks, I mean, Damon Wilson, Jakeem Jackson, Lucas Simmons was at, you know, outside the top 10, and FSU freaking loved him. Reuben Bain, top 15 level prospect that year. King Mack, who's already playing for Penn State, I believe. 23 was a nice class. 24 was a really nice class as well. 22, I'm trying to just go back here through history. 22, Marvin Jones, Dalen Everett, Jihad Campbell, Gabe Brownlow Denley, Shamar Stewart, Tyler Booker, Earl Little, Nigel Lee Kelly, Keon Saab, who's now at Alabama, Kenyatta Jackson, Amari Nyblack, Bear Alexander, AZ Thomas, Chris Graves, Hastings, Katron Allen, Wesley Besaint. I mean, 22, I don't know. I'm not going to just bag all over this class because it is early March and we will see more development. We will see more testing. We'll see more camps and we'll see more 7-on-7. So I'm not sounding the alarm on this. I'm just saying, like, guys, this is a lighter, This class so far is definitely behind, I think, any recent class in memory. I don't know why that is. It's just sometimes it is cyclical. I actually like a lot of these 2026 players quite a bit. So we'll see how it continues to evolve. I don't know. I do know that I'll be back later this week with Graham, and we will do a more of a deep dive on some of this stuff. And I really appreciate y'all listening to the Nolecast. This was fun. Probably a little rambling. I did not expect to go 55 minutes, but take care, y'all. Be blessed, and we will see you back soon.